Welcome back, everyone. And today we have our second part of our fireside chat on density functional theory. And in particular, it's the one that I call density functional practice. Just to remind everyone what is the plan for this three webinar series. Yesterday, we had a more conceptual part on electronic instruction methods and density functional theory. In particular, today will actually be dedicated to the practice of what do we need to do this calculation using a modern plane wave pseudopotential code. And tomorrow it will be, I think, again, conceptual, understanding what are the properties that we can calculate, those that we cannot calculate, and for those that we can, how accurate we are. Yesterday, I think we reached very quickly the limit of 500 participants, so I'm very sorry that some of you couldn't attend, but we have already put the slides and the talk and also just the audio on the Materials Cloud Learn section, and it's also actually on YouTube, and we'll do the same today and later on. For tomorrow's webinar. Let me actually also monitor the chat. We have, as yesterday, four panelists, Francesco Ramirez, Norma Rivano, Luca Binci, and Davide Grassano. They will monitor on my behalf the chat. We don't have the time to answer questions in real time, but they will be collecting, if it's something very simple, they'll answer in real time in the chat. But by next week, you'll also find all the questions that, you know, we deem relevant. We collected 40 yesterday, and their answer in a PDF file also on the Materials Cloud. Today's webinar is also special in the sense that there is a homework, if you want, to practice some of this calculation. There are instructions on the Materials Cloud. There is a GitHub section where you can download a handout with instruction on how to either install Quantum Express or just install VirtualBox and run a virtual machine with a Linux environment on whatever machine you have, either Windows, Mac, or Linux, and to go through actual calculations. So, and I will focus here on teaching you how to do these calculations. One thing, one slide that I left out from yesterday, I was planning to present it tomorrow, but maybe this is relevant already, is a set of pointers on educational material. Here is a, let's say, a long list. There are some online resources. I've just pointed out to some, Gerd Seder and myself ran a class on atomistic simulation for many, many years at MIT. Actually, some of the material here is based on that class that we kept teaching here in Lausanne or in Berkeley. And so you can use that. There are videos, there are lecture notes. We accumulate materials on the Learn section of the Materials Cloud. There are plenty of other online resources. Stefan Cotoniera runs an online streamed class on the field, and you can just Google around. In terms of books, these are some of my favorites, books on fundamentals of quantum mechanics. The two books by Branson and Joachim are, I think, particularly good. If you want to learn more about the fundamental of density functional theory, the Parr and Young book is very good. Or if you want to learn about advanced electronic instruction methods, the two books by Richard Martin and then Lucia Reining and David Sepperly are very good. And if you have more an eye on material simulation, the books by Tim Kaxira, Sorge Konov, and Feliciano Giustino. And if you needed just one book to bring with you on a desert island, it would be either the Parr and Young if you want to, you know, learn about the fundamentals, or it would be the Giustino if you wanted to learn about the practice. And if it's a really nice desert island, I can come and actually teach you on the fly. Now, let me sort of get to where we left it yesterday. So the Coenberg and Cohn theorem introduce the fundamentally exact concept that we can deal with an energy that is a function of the charge density, and we have even a variational principle. The only catch is that we don't know what that universal functional of the charge density is. Cohn and Sham do a very cunning attempt to identify how we could approximate that functional, breaking apart the universal functional F into three terms, TS, kinetic energy of the non-interacting Cohn and Sham electrons, a Hartree term, and then they push everything that is not known into the third term, the exchange correlation functional. Now, in doing this, they reintroduce orbitals. You see, it's not anymore a theory of a functional theory of the density. Now there are just, again, single particle orbitals. It's still exact. Everything is, you know, being compressed back into the exchange correlation functional. And for the exchange correlation functional, we'll need to find approximations. And as always, we have a functional, so we have also the corresponding Euler-Lagrange equation that today we'll actually solve in real life. And so the equations that correspond to the minimum of that functional, we call them in this context Cohn and Sham equation. They look very familiar. We have a quantum kinetic energy term, we have a Hartree potential, we have an external potential, and everything that we had pushed back into this unknown exchange correlation energy now becomes, in the Euler-Lagrange equation, a functional derivative with respect to the charge density. And so we call that the exchange correlation potential. So this is just exchange correlation. And as I said, you know, Cohn and Sham were both bright and lucky. They, you know, followed Fermi's idea of using the local density approximation, but not for the kinetic energy, for the exchange correlation. So for anything that is non-homogeneous, we construct the exchange correlation energy for that system by going point by point, and at every point assigning a density of exchange correlation energy that is the same density of the homogeneous non-interacting gas. So we build with all these infinitesimal Lego bricks, each one at its density, the total exchange correlation energy. So why they were bright and lucky at the same time? Well, because the local density approximation for the exchange correlation satisfy first and very beautifully a fundamental constraint on the exchange and correlation that, you know, they didn't know at the time. But basically, and you can imagine that in fairly intuitive physical terms, what happens if you are an electron sitting somewhere, basically you are creating around you a lack of probability of finding another electron. So because, you know, electrons repel each other. I mean, if you are in squeezed in an underground train, it's very unlikely that you'll find someone, you know, 1 millimeter close to you, unless you know you want to be there. So in general, because electrons repel each other, they create around themselves a hole that is called the exchange correlation hole. So first, the LDA satisfy this exact minus one constraint that the exchange correlation hole should integrate to minus one. And that's the first thing, but it's not the only thing. And actually, there are some very beautiful calculations done by the group of Richard Nitz in Cambridge, looking at this exchange correlation hole with accurate stochastic methods with diffusion Monte Carlo. And here, this exchange correlation hole is done for a number of interacting electrons in a very simple potential, in this sinusoidal potential that is here. And you know what we are asking ourselves, if I'm at the ground state and I put myself here, what is the decrease of probability that surrounds me, this exchange correlation hole? And I can calculate it in quantum Monte Carlo, and that's what you have on the left, the Monte Carlo Hall, and I can calculate it with LDA. So first of all, LDA integrates to the right quantity, but it also starts to look seriously good. Now, the catch is that if I now look not at the exchange correlation hall where I'm sitting at the top of this potential, but I move around, you'll see a little movie of these holes as I move to the bottom and I go back to the top. On the left, you see the exact results, and on the right, you see the LDA results. And as you can see, I mean, it's actually so beautiful that I want to run it twice. You see here, it's a desperation. So in the, at the bottom of the potential, the two exchange correlation hole looks very different. And actually, I won't do it, but through thermodynamic integration, you can see that you can derive the exact exchange correlation energy from the exact exchange correlation hole. So the two are related. But as you saw, LDA here was doing a very good job, but at the bottom of that potential does a very poor job. What is its saving grace? Well, it's the fact that actually in the exact expression for the exchange correlation energy coming from the exchange correlation hole, the only thing that matters is the spherical average. So it doesn't matter the explicit form of its hole, but what matters is the spherical average of this hole. And the spherical average of this hole is much better behaved. These are again quantum Monte Carlo results, and LDA does quite a good job. So the idea from 1965 of Kohn and Sham of using LDA turned out to be very successful. We have already seen Marvin Cohen calculations of the phase diagram of silicon in its different phases. And, you know, these are just examples from 20 years ago from Chris Picard looking at very simple mechanical properties. In this case, it's just the equilibrium lattice parameter across a few different classes of compounds. I'll show tomorrow much more extensive examples. But you see, what we have is that the lattice parameter at the LDA level is actually very good. I mean, the error that we do, and there is no experimental input, so this is completely from a first principle, is of the order of, 1% at worst in the lattice parameter. That would be 3% on the volume. Elastic constants that, come from the derivatives of the energy, the second derivative around this lattice parameter, sorry, the bulk modulus, say, starts to be a little bit trickier, but we'll see that tomorrow. But the bottom line here is that the LDA was already incredibly good. So everything that we have done ever since, I'll briefly mention it in a moment, is a tiny improvement on top of this. We might think that we have had major improvements, and it was very difficult to get those, improvements that are very important, but LDA was very, very good. And just historically, of course, if you have built an exchange correlation from a local density approximation and you want to make things better, it might be very, natural to do something perturbative and say, let's add maybe the gradients of the charge density to make things better, and that was done. But at the beginning, it was actually decreasing the quality of the results, and the reason for that was that actually the exact integral rule on the exchange correlation all integrating to minus one was not satisfied, and that's why this concept of generalized gradient approximation was introduced by John Perdue and others, that is a gradient approximation that preserved this fundamental rule. And a lot of the effort in constructing a new exchange correlation functional has been driven by the desire to satisfy some of these constraints that can be very many. This is just an example. But once we had, correct gradient expansions that satisfy the sum rule, it was seen that we could actually do quite a lot better, especially when it was a matter of comparing, say, maybe energies or like here equation of states under very different chemical regime or coordination regime. This is an example of the phase transition from alpha quartz to stishovite. Stishovite is a high pressure form of alpha quartz. Again, it's found if you look at rocks under meteorites, again, if you're lucky, and you see these two equation of states, you remember how well the transition pressure was coming for silicon from the diamond phase to beta-tin. Well, here it turns out that if you use the LDA, the two equation of states have the minimum at the same energy. So you don't really need any pressure to go from one equation of state to the other. And that's really in disagreement with experiment. And on Hammond show, you see more than 25 years ago, that actually, if you did a GGA calculation of these two phases, the common tangent was giving a transition pressure that was in a much better agreement with experiments. And from then onwards has been a proliferation of exchange correlation functional. There is the Lebesgue-C library in the solid state community developed by Miguel Marquez that I think has reached almost 500 functionals. I will not try to describe in any sense all of them. We'll have tomorrow a better discussion. You have understood very well what LDA is. GGAs are exchange correlation functionals that introduce these generalized gradients. The solid state community, the materials community, is actually quite fond of the PBE functional from 1996. And if you do a lot of solid state calculation, a very tiny variation on that, that had a couple of parameters fitted not on molecular energies, but on solid state structures, is actually quite a bit better, especially there are a number of materials like perovskites, oxides, that would come out better in PV solo. So this would be my go-to functional as a standard. I will discuss the van der Waals corrections of this functional that are again a very successful story of the last, I would say 10, 20 years tomorrow. I will mention some fancier, more complex extension. One that I'm fond of and no one looks at, it's the weighted density approximation, something that, you know, when it was introduced was quite cumbersome, so it never took off, but it has very elegant properties on the response function, actually, so it would be still a very interesting field of study. To go beyond the gradients, of course, the Laplacian could be again a natural step. We have to be careful on how to introduce them. Those were introduced only maybe 15 years ago. And around 5 years ago, a meta-GGA functional that is called SCAN, strongly constrained and appropriately normed, has become very popular. And, you know, it improves in a number of cases and on a number of important averages onto PBE solo. There are some subtleties that I'll mention later on that have to do with the pseudopotential and pseudopotential generation, because as you build those, you want to make sure that your exchange correlation for those calculations is consistent with what you do later. And something that has become very popular starting from the chemistry community, where not only Hartree-Fock calculations are very common, but tend to be also very inexpensive due to the use of the Gaussian basis set, are hybrid functionals. In the solid state community, the Skuseri-Erdershoff, the HSC functional, is very common. Those mix a certain amount of exchange and correlation coming from something like PBE or revised PBE with a certain amount of exact Fock exchange, or often just the short range part, not to inherit from Hartree-Fock this tendency to make to turn metal into insulators. I'll discuss more of this tomorrow. So right now, I want just to leave you with a zoology of exchange correlation functional, the comment that LDA was great to begin with. PBE and PBE-Sol make some subtle but significant improvements. SCAN makes some improvement on top. There are still qualitative features that we'll discuss tomorrow that are related to self-interaction, and that is addressed in part by hybrids, by Hubbard functional. We'll discuss them tomorrow. And with the meta-GGA, keep in mind also this caveat about the need in principle to use consistent pseudopotentials that have been generated with the same exchange correlation functional. But here, if you want, is all the physical quality of your model. That is, if your exchange correlation functional were exact, you would have the perfect energy. So anything that is not a numerical error, that is what mostly we'll discuss now in the rest of the presentation, comes from either a physical shortcoming of your exchange correlation functional or actually from the physical quality of your exchange correlation functional. But sadly, there is not a systematic way to make these exchange correlation functionals better, although there are some very interesting and nice ideas based on what is called the adiabatic connection. And so in some ways here, it's all the intuition, you know, there is the perspective of Jean Perdue that you have to impose a lot of known constraints on your exchange correlation function, and that is absolutely a very good idea. You'll see there are still qualitative failures that we'll discuss tomorrow and that are important. Some are intrinsic and some are just related to our imperfect knowledge of what should be the exact exchange correlation functional. Okay, with this, we take for a moment a pause from the concepts and detail of density functional theory, and we delve into this general issue on the fact that we have now created our Kohn-Sham equations. These do not look very different from Hartree or Hartree-Fock. So the only difference between these three approaches is having either the LDA or GGA or whatever exchange correlation function here, or the Hartree and the exchange term here. Sorry, the Hartree is always there also in density functional theory, or just the Hartree equation. But in general, we have to solve these differential equations. In addition, you know, all of these contain the solution. So the orbitals that solve this differential equation, you know, build up the charge density that is, say, a constituent of the Hartree operator and the Hartree energy. And so we need from the solutions to build the operators, find the solution, build the operators, and self-consistently converge this cycle. How do we solve a differential equation? Well, if this was the 19th century, you would probably learn what the hypergeometric function is. You would learn about Laguerre polynomials and you know all the great accomplishment of analysis. We're not going to do that also because the system we're going to solve are very complex. So we're going to use a computer. So we are going to turn a differential equation into something that is computable. How do we do that? By actually transforming our unknown object. You know, in the differential equation, we need to find a solution, we need to find a wave function, into an algebra or linear algebra problem that is rather than finding what is the unknown psi, we are going to find what are the coefficients. These are real or complex numbers, the CON, that represent the expansion of the unknown wave function psi into a basis of well-known, typically analytical function phi. So let me give you an example. Suppose you know our ultimate goal was to solve a differential equation that was giving me as a solution something that looked like this. You know, maybe this looks like a Gaussian, or maybe it looks almost like a Gaussian, but not exactly. Maybe let's say for simplicity we are in periodic boundary conditions. So here my periodic boundary drawing skill are quite pathetic, but this thing is periodic. How can we, you know, transform this differential problem? Well, we could expand with Fourier analysis this unknown red function psi into a linear combination of sines and cosines, or actually, probably because this looks as if it were symmetric around zero, probably we just need only cosines. And here is an example. You see, I plotted cosines of a different wavelength. This is the one with the largest wavelength. And then we go to finer and finer wavelength. And each of these cosines, sorry, I'm not drawing very well here, has a certain coefficient, C1, C2, C3. And so maybe if 10 cosines are good enough to describe the psi very well, what I need to solve my problem is actually finding those 10 coefficients. And you see those 10 coefficients need to be such that around the zero day, all the cosines sum up constructively, and the zone boundaries where minus 8 is, they sum up destructively. So you have a maximum, then flat, and then a maximum again. So let me actually show how formally this allows us to solve the Schrödinger equation in our case, but it could be any other differential equation, or it could be the Cohn-Sham equation, or it could be the Hartree-Fock equation, whatever this Hamiltonian operator is. And I'm using, again, the Dirac notation, so this cat here in real space would just be a wave function psi of r. And so the core answers, the core hypothesis that I make is that I expand this psi as a linear combination of basis elements. And these basis elements, I choose them to be orthogonal to make my life easier. So what I say is that the scalar product with between, say, the basis element n and the basis element m is going to be equal to 1 or 0, depending if n is equal or different from m. In you know, a standard first quantization picture, this would be the integral of fm star times fn of r. And of course, you understand right away that if m is equal to n, this is equal to 1 from the normalization condition. And if they are different, well, I'm imposing that this scalar product is different. And you can see that, say, if you take sine of 3x and cosine of 3x, you see right away that they are orthogonal by symmetry. We don't have to have this orthogonality. We can work with a basis set that is non-orthogonal. It's just to simplify the algebra here. So how do I make progress here? If you, for a moment, are familiar also with the concept of Hilbert space and the psi being a vector in Hilbert space, you understand that H psi is also a vector in Hilbert space. And what I'm going to do is I'm going to project the left-hand side of this equation, H psi, and the right-hand side of this equation, a constant times psi, onto phi 1, phi 2, phi 3. So if H psi was a vector in Cartesian space, it would have three coordinates. Say the vector could be 1, 2, 7, and these three coordinates are the projection of the vector onto the three different versors, 100, 010, and 001, that constitute the basis of my three-dimensional Cartesian space. Here, my Hilbert space has many dimensions. In principle, it could have infinite dimension. I'm taking a basis set of orthogonal normalized versors. So these phi n are the equivalent of the versors of Cartesian space. And I project my Schrödinger or my Hartree-Fock or my Kohn-Eschamps equation onto each of these versors. So if for simplicity, I suppose that I have 10 elements in my basis set, it could be 1,000, it could be 1 million, but let's suppose there are only 10. I have to project my differential equation onto those 10 versors. So m goes from 1 to 10. So now I don't have any more a vectorial identity as it was here, but here I have scalars. I have projected this. So you see, I have scalars on the left and scalars on the right. And I have right now, out of this projection, 10 different conditions for phi 1, phi 2, phi 3, phi 10. But I have still to exploit, let me change color just for the sake of it, I still have to exploit this ansatz, that is, I've expanded psi as a linear combination of my basis set with unknown coefficients. So I'm going to put for psi this linear sum, and so the net result is here. You see, when I calculate the scalar product phi m psi, this is going to be equal to sum over n, cn, phi m, phi n. But phi n, because of orthogonality, that's the simplification, is going to be equal to Kronecker's delta. And so this is going to be equal to cm. And there is my cn. I can't do the same trick on the left-hand side, so I have to keep all my complexity. So I have the sum for n that goes from 1 to 10 of this unknown coefficient, cn, times, this is again a scalar, is the expectation value of the Hamiltonian, could be Schrödinger, could be Kohn-Eschamps, could be Hartree-Fock, between these two basis elements. And this is actually a matrix element that we could write as HMN. So in a shorthand form, my 10 equations, so remember M goes from 1 to 10, my 10 equations are represented here, where the matrix HMN has 100 elements, because M can go from 1 to 10 and N can go from 1 to 10, and this is the expectation value of phi m h phi n. So we have 10 equations that are a matrix. The matrix is known, h, m, n, and that's why it's good to have a simple analytical function in those phi m and phi n, because when I apply h to phi n, I want to be able to calculate the Laplacian and the second derivative, so I want something analytical. So if I if I've chosen my basis set, I can calculate my matrix elements, and now I have to solve these 10 matrix, these 10 linear equations that are really written in a much simpler form as a matrix vector multiplication. You see, if I look at the multiplication of the first row, h1 to 1 to h1, 10, times c1, c10, being equal to ec1, this is exactly the first equation for m equal to 1. And then for m equal to 2, I have this equation that is the product of this row times the same column, equal to ec2, and so on and so forth. So you see how I've taken a differential equation. My only hypothesis was choosing a basis set. The unknown have become the coefficients of the expansion of my unknown wave function into this basis set, and it's become a linear algebra problem. This is something that a computer understands. you have to do matrix times vector equal to a constant times a vector. I can actually bring, sorry, let me go back. I can bring the vector on the left-hand side, so I can make this equal to zero. And what I have here is that on the diagonal, I have h22 minus epsilon, h33, sorry, minus e, down to hkk minus e. So now I have even a simpler equation in linear algebra. I have matrix time vector equal to zero. And you know from linear algebra that the only case where this has a non-trivial solution for the coefficients, so you know, if the 10 coefficients are zero, okay, I've solved the problem, but it's not interesting. The only time when I have a non-trivial solution is when the determinant of the matrix is equal to zero. Often I wrote the determinant as this. And you know, a determinant here, the unknown is E. This is the eigenvalue of my equation. I know the 10 by 10 Hamiltonian matrix represented on that basis. And this is going to be a polynomial of a 10th degree for this specific case, or nth degree in general. So it has n solutions, let's say 10 solutions. Those 10 solutions will be the 10 eigenvalues of my problem. And then for each eigenvalue, I can go back and I can solve and find the non-trivial set of coefficients C1, CK that give me the eigenvector that I'm looking for. So this is how we do differential equation on a computer, and you don't have to be interested in quantum mechanics to know these things. You know, differential equations are ubiquitous in science and engineering. If you want to make your plane fly, you probably have to solve to begin with some differential equation. So this is a very general technique. It's not the only approach that we have to solve the problem, because we could have gone back and thought not at the Euler-Lagrange equation that were related to our variational functional, but actually we could have attacked the functional directly. I've rewritten here for you the Kone-Sham energy functional. You see, it's a functional of the charge density. It's a function of the psi I, and I'm going now to expand the psi I in this basis set. So my psi I of R is written as a linear combination with certain coefficients of my basis set phi n. So I have the n index that sum over all the possible basis set, and the I index that index the particular electronic states that I want to consider. And if I have 10 electrons, you see I have 10 electronic states. Well, now again, I can put this expression for each of my psi I into this energy functional, and I can work out all those integrals. And so the unknown remain my coefficients that I want to find for every possible psi I. So I will have here C11, C12, up to C1k, and then depending on how many electrons I have, Cn1 up to Cnk. So a lot of coefficients that our computers have to deal with, but finding the solution to my problem can also be stated in this equivalent form, in which I have to minimize the functional, the energy functional, with respect to all my coefficients. So I can see the problem of getting to the ground state as a nonlinear minimization problem. We'll see examples at the end of today. For the time being, we actually think at solving the differential equation as a linear algebra problem, as in version of that matrix. Now, we have spoken about basis sets in general, but let's actually focus in our actual calculation what would be an ideal basis set. And if you're a quantum chemist, often you're dealing with molecules, so It's convenient because you don't want to describe a wave function in the empty space around the molecule. You want to describe it only where the molecule is, to have a maybe localized basis set. It could be atomic orbitals. You might want to decide if you want your basis set to be orthogonal or not orthogonal, and then you have to keep track of the non-orthogonality in terms of overlap matrix. It's very common to use a basis set based on Gaussians, because then the Hartree-Fock exchange integrals becomes very inexpensive. We are going to deal with extended system. Those could be perfectly crystalline systems, like a piece of silicon that can be described very well by two atoms periodically repeated. But it could be also, say, an amorphous system that is a solid but is not periodic, or a liquid system that, again, it's extended but not periodic. And even in all those cases, suppose we want to study, say, water, liquid water as it exists in my water glass, it's much better, rather than to describe a droplet of water with all the water molecules seen, and then taking the limit of the water droplet being very large, so that the surface effect that goes as the square of the radius become negligible with respect to the volume effect that go as the cube of the radius. So it's much better to actually get to the limit of the infinite droplet, not by studying a finite droplet that becomes bigger and bigger, but to study a system that is periodic. A periodic system has the beauty that is both infinite and infinite. So you see, if I put five water molecules in my simulation cell, that maybe it's cubic, and I repeat them periodically, what I have is that my system is infinite in the sense that there are no surfaces. So I don't have to worry about the surface effects. But it's also finite in the sense that I have only, say, 15 independent atoms. Sorry, yeah, 15 independent atoms, 45 degrees of freedom in the ionic coordinates. But what I can do is then, rather than study five water molecules, I can study 10 water molecules periodically repeated, and then I can study 20, 30, and so on. And what happens is that because I've never have surfaces in this, I get to the limit where the properties of my system don't change anymore. I reached what is called the thermodynamic limit much, much faster if I were to study the increasing droplet. So studying systems in periodic boundary conditions is very convenient to study anything that is extended. A solid, for which it's natural, a crystalline solid, but also an amorphous solid, a glass, or even a liquid. If you study molecules, it's not as good, but you can study still it very easily by putting the molecules in a unit cell that is large enough so that its periodic image doesn't feel the effects of the original one. So if these two benzene molecules are far away so that their wave functions don't overlap, and they don't have relevant dipoles or quadrupoles with which they interact electrostatically, molecule A will think that it's the only molecule in the universe because it doesn't feel molecule B. And so even if it's studied in periodic boundary condition, that means every time I move this hydrogen atom, also this hydrogen atom moves, it doesn't feel the effect. So it thinks that it is alone in the universe. So we'll use periodic boundary conditions to study solids. And for that, I want to give you a quick refresher of periodicity and the translational operations in three dimensions, because this will be actually the language with which we study periodic systems like silicon, or we set up our calculation even for a water or for a glass. And you're probably familiar with this concept of a Bravais lattice. A Bravais lattice is a mathematical concept. If you want, it's embodied in having three primitive lattice vectors that we call A1, A2, and A3, that they do not lie in the same plane. We look at the infinite set of vectors R that are spanned by the linear combination of A1, A2, and A3 with integer coefficients L, M, and N. L can be, they belong to Z, so they can be positive integers, negative integers, or zero. And Bravais, now we remember his name because he was the first in 1848 to classify correctly the fact that in three dimensions there are 14 qualitatively different Bravais lattices. Someone before him thought that there were 15, and everyone has forgotten his name, poor thing, and I will not mention it today. So these are the 14 Bravais lattices. I will not go into the detail. We divided them in 7 crystal classes, divided them in simple, volume, body, or face-centered. Maybe in the case of a cubic system, it's worth remembering we have the simple cubic, we have the body-centered cubic, and we have the face-centered cubic. And if we wanted to represent, say, an infinite crystal of silicon, the crystal, is a diamond lattice. That means it's made by 2 silicon atoms repeated periodically with the translation operation of the Bravais cubic face-centered lattice. So a real physical object, like a silicon crystal, is made by a physical group of atoms. We also call that a basis. In the case of silicon, 2 atoms periodically repeated with the mathematical translation of the Bravais lattice. If you take a piece of a ferromagnetic iron, that can be represented by 1 iron atom periodically repeated using the volume center, the BCC cubic lattice. Sadly, this definition is not unique. I can represent silicon not by taking, say, 2 atoms and repeating them periodically with the FCC operation, but I could take these 4 atoms that I'm painting in green right now, and I could repeat them with the simple cubic operation. So in some ways, I've created a supercell that contains 4 atoms. I've changed my translation operation. The net result is an infinite system that has been described equally well. Okay, so with this, let me also introduce the concept of the reciprocal lattice. Here we have a direct lattice that is a simple cubic, apologies, the symbols are not coming out well, described in general by the linear combination of A1, A2, and A3. Solid spheres could be the Bravais lattice points, or they could be, real physical atoms. But what I'm going to define is the reciprocal lattice. And for that, I'll introduce the concept that maybe you're familiar with of a plane wave. So in real space, it's the exponential of the imaginary unit I times a vector g, a wave vector g, times r. So what is the characteristic of a plane wave? Well, its modulation is going to be along the direction of the g wave vector. This is because any point that lies in a plane perpendicular to g will have the same scalar product between any point, this point, this point, this point, and g. So the scalar product is the same. So the value, the amplitude of the plane wave is the same at every point. And as we move along this direction, we are going to have a real and an imaginary part that are both, cosinusoidal and sinusoidal. And the wavelength is going to be very large if the modulus of g is very small, because if the modulus of g is very small, I have to move a long way with R before G dot R has changed by amount by an amount of pi that would be the phase inversion in the plane waves. So G is small, wavelength is long, G is large, wavelength is short. And we are going to define a set of G vectors such that the plane wave IG dot R is, we say, compatible with my primitive direct lattice. So you see, if I have a plane wave that looks like this, this is compatible because it has the same amplitude at every point of the Bravais lattice. That amplitude doesn't have to be zero. I mean, it could have been this plane wave shifted. It still has the same amplitude at all the point of the Bravais lattice. But if I were to take for a moment this orange plane wave here, this is not compatible because it doesn't have the same amplitude. So if my Bravais lattice was one-dimensional, you understand right away that the plane waves, I'll do the real part or the imaginary part, sines and cosines, that are compatible are this, you know, something like the fundamental harmonics. And then what I can have is, you know, two wavelengths, and then it becomes difficult. I could have three wavelengths and any higher wavelength. So how do I define mathematically this condition? If I want the amplitude to be the same at every point, what I want is this equality here. That is, I want my plane wave to have the same amplitude at an arbitrary point R and a translated point by a Bravais lattice vector capital R. So if I work out the algebra for a generic capital R, I want this to be true. And you see it right away that this is going to be true if G has the form that is in itself a Bravais lattice form, as a linear combination of three primitive lattice vectors, B1, B2, and B3, where B1, B2, and B3 have the property that they are dual to the direct lattice vector. So BI, scalar product AJ, I have, you know, three B vectors, I have three A vectors, and the scalar product between each one of the three B and each one of the three J needs to give me 0 or 1, depending if he is equal or different from J. This is the property of a dual, and you can work out the algebra that if I have A1, A2, and A3, B1, B2, and B3 are defined by this cross product, while at the denominator here, this is nothing else than the volume of the unit cell. Okay, so this was an introduction to Bravais lattice. Why is it important? Because we need it to construct our input file for our simulations, because we might want to study silicon, and the simplest way to study silicon is saying that it is given by an FCC Bravais lattice. So in the language of Quantum Espresso, IBRAV is equal to 2. And then given this translational symmetry, you still need to specify that you have two atoms that would be at a certain distance from each other. And in particular, if this is the conventional unit cell A, you could say put one atom in 0, 0, 0. You could put the other in 1/4, 1/4, 1/4 A. And then you could repeat all of this with the FCC lattice translations that are given by these three Bravais lattice vectors. So that's the importance of Bravais lattices for Quantum Espresso. In general, Bravais lattices have also relevance on how we classify electronic states in a system. You know, remember for a moment the charge density, say, of density functional theory is going to be given by the sum over all the occupied states of the square modulus of each one of these Kone-Sham electrons. So in general, what we have often to do is to take a sum over all the occupied states to get physical quantities like the charge density or the total energy. In a solid, things are tricky because the system is infinite, so we can do infinite sum, and we'll do appropriate coarse grading of this infinite sum using reciprocal space concepts. Let me start reminding you, one of the fundamental theorem of condensed matter physics, the fact that if the Hamiltonian commutes with any translation given by a lattice, Bravais lattice vector R, okay, so if applying the Hamiltonian first and the lattice translation afterwards, or the lattice translation first and the Hamiltonian later, gives you the same result, if these two operators commute, what you can conclude, I will not demonstrate this for you, is that the eigenstates of the Hamiltonian can be expressed in a form where they have also very well-defined symmetry properties with respect to the translation. Sadly and interestingly, these symmetry properties are not that the eigenstates of the Hamiltonian are periodic. The charge density is periodic, is a physical quantity, but the eigenstates are not periodic. The eigenstates of a periodic Hamiltonian have the block form, that is, they are written in terms of a periodic function times, again, a plane wave, where the wave vector of the plane wave belongs to the first Brillouin zone. And I remind you that if we have, say, a reciprocal lattice, so suppose that we are in two dimensions, and we had a simple square lattice in direct space, we have a simple square lattice in reciprocal space. These are my G vectors, this is the origin. Let's call it this G1, G2, G3, G4, G5. These are the, you see, the second nearest neighbors, G6, G7, G8. So these are the reciprocal lattice vector. So what is the Brillouin zone? Is the Wigner size cell of the reciprocal lattice. So what I do is I bisect all the lines that connect a lattice point to its nearest neighbors. And I would have also these bisections. And then I take the internal convolution, and the internal convolution is this. So this is my Brillouin zone, and so my K belongs to this first Brillouin zone. So Bloch theorem tells me that at variance with a molecule, where I have molecular orbitals that I classify with integers, in an infinite system where I have infinite number of electrons, I have also some continuum quantum number, and this continuum quantum number is this K that is called the Bloch quasi-momentum, or sometimes the Bloch momentum, and I classify every state in a solid with an integer number that is the band index N, and with a continuum number in the first Brillouin zone that is the Bloch quasi-momentum. And so it's very common, both in experiments, you can measure those with ARPES, or in simulations, to plot what are the possible energy states for any possible integer number n, for any possible band index, and for any possible crystal momentum or crystal quasi-momentum, and that is the band structure of a solid. Okay, so we are looking at what are all the possible energy levels for these solids, and those of you that don't need to take this webinar will recognize here a classic ferroelectric perovskites with a band gap with the two peace states here. And so in orange, I've plotted the occupied bands. Maybe in blue, I'm plotting the empty bands. But these bands are the values of energy that are allowed by my periodic Hamiltonian. Could be the true one, it could be the Hartree-Fock, it could be the Kone-Sham, for every possible integer n and for every possible block momentum k. And Bloch's theorem tells us, here maybe I'm just using an x variable, one dimensional, that my wave function psi is not periodic, but is the product of a periodic wave function u times a plane wave. And you see the periodic wave function u is this, you know, atomic-like function that I'm plotting here. So this is periodic, so this is u and k, and it will vary as a function of n and as a function of k, but it is periodic. And the product of u and k in, let's make it blue, times e to the I kx, that is in red, is going to give me the wave function psi that you see is this black wave function is not periodic, but is the product of something periodic times a red modulation. Okay, I think to give everyone some breathing space, we'll stop for 5 minutes. So we'll start again at 7. So I'll stop for 5 minutes the video and you can all take a breath. Okay, let's go back. So we have looked at how the wave function looks like, and as I move around, say if this is the zone center and this is the zone boundary, what I go is from a modulation that has a very long wavelength to a modulation that starts to change phase every time I cross a lattice vector. So the important message here is that Bloch theorem has told me what is the shape of psi. It's not periodic, but is the product of a periodic part times a phase modulation. And so is this periodic part U and K, this blue part, that we need to know for every band, that is for every index n, and for every k, so for every continuum momentum in the Brillouin zone, is this blue periodic term that is going to be expanded in plane waves. Because this is periodic, the plane waves, and that was the important concept of reciprocal space, the g are chosen such that e to the I g dot r has the same periodicity or higher periodicities compatible with my direct lattice, and so I can expand u and k as a linear combination of plane waves. This is what your code does. It approximates the periodic part of the Bloch function as a linear combination of plane waves. The better you want it to approximate, the more plane waves you need. If your u and k in your material happens to have a lot of structure, you are not going to be able to simulate it with just a few plane waves, because you'll need to go to plane waves that have a very high periodicity to be able to describe all that fine structures. And for each of those plane waves, you'll need to know what the coefficient C is, the coefficient C of that plane wave G for that band N and for that K point K. So in a typical plane wave calculation, you might have a basis set that is of the order of thousands, tens of thousands of plane waves. You can have bands that are 10, 20, 100, 1000. The K can be a lot. We'll discuss the K in a moment. So a lot of coefficients. So that's why you need computers. What is good and what is bad about a plane wave basis set? Exactly as in hi-fi, is very easy to improve the resolution. Okay, so when in 1981 and 1982, Philips came out with the CD-ROM, what they were doing is they were sampling sound so that you could have basically all frequencies up to around 22 kilohertz, relying on the fact that most rich people that were buying CDs at the time wouldn't have the sensitivity of, you know, a 12-year-old that can go to 25 kilohertz. Also, it was good because then you could fit the Ninth Symphony of Beethoven in just one CD, and that was a major point, I guess. You know, it's very important over there in Northern Europe. But so by taking more and more plane waves, you're able to describe with finer and finer resolution your wave function. So you can make it systematically better and better. You need a lot of them. And if you were to, you know, need to describe, say, in a piece of gold, both the valence electron of golds that are very smooth, but maybe the 1s electron of gold that are extremely localized around the nuclei, you would have an untenable number of basis elements. And what you will discover in a moment is that we are not going to study explicitly the core electrons in a solid that are very sharply varying in space, but are also not very active in forming and creating chemical bonds. We are only studying valence or so-called semivalence electrons, and luckily those are very smooth. I'll show you an example in a moment that it's very easy to calculate the gradient or the Laplacian of a plane wave expression. I'll comment later on that is very easy to calculate because it's very easy to calculate the Laplacian is very easy to calculate the kinetic energy operator. So remember, if we simplify for a moment and we think at a Hamiltonian as being a kinetic energy plus a potential, and the kinetic energy is thus minus 1/2 del square, the matrix element of the kinetic energy between two plane waves is super easy to calculate, because basically if I have a plane wave e to the I g dot r, its gradient is equal to I g times e to the I g dot r. So I see I've done a derivative automatically, and its Laplacian is going to be equal to minus g square e to the I g dot r. So twice, you know, I've taken the, if you want, divergence of the gradient. So very, very easy to deal with this. And it's also very, very easy to go from real to reciprocal space. So if I have a quantity that is written, say, as in this case, the charge density that is periodic, as a linear expansion in plane waves with coefficient rho of g. So either I know the coefficients rho of g, the coefficient of the plane waves, and so I have the reciprocal space expression of the rho g. But using a fast Fourier transform, it's very, very fast to go from the rho g to the rho of r, where r belong to a direct space mesh. Say this could be the Wigner size cell of my crystal, belong to an equispaced Wigner size cell that is nothing else than the dual of my set of G vectors. So fast Fourier transform allow us, if we have the rho sampled in real space on a grid, to give us the coefficients rho of g very efficiently. The cost is just linear times the logarithm of the linear cost, so it's just above linear. Or if I have the rho g, to go back to the rho on a mesh, so I can go back from real and reciprocal space very, very easily. And you know, one of the fundamental concepts that you'll use when you do a quantum espresso or any kind, you know, it could be a VASP, it could be a CASTEP, it could be an ABINIT calculation, how do you select what is your plane wave basis set? Well, suppose this is my reciprocal space. So these are my G vectors, this is gamma, this is the set of G vectors. So to every one of these generic G vectors, this is G1, this was G2, I can give them names, there corresponds a plane wave. The larger the G is, so this one has a periodicity that is shorter than this one, and this one has a periodicity that is longer. So, sorry, the opposite. So if I call this A, B, C, and D, A has a periodicity that is longer than B, that is that has two wavelengths in the space that A has one wavelength, and C has three wavelengths, and D has four wavelengths. So as I go to larger and larger G vectors, I have plane waves that become more and more detailed, and so they express better and better the fine features of my wave function. So how do I choose what is my basis set? I choose the radius of a sphere centered around the origin. And if I give you this radius, What I'm saying is you're going to use all the G vectors that follow inside this sphere. And then I can choose a larger radius. And what I have is a basis set that contains all the previous basis set elements and more, so it has become systematically better. So choosing a cutoff radius is a very economical and efficient way to express what is the basis set that I'm going to use. And actually, rather than using the cutoff radius, we give the energy that corresponds to that radius, because if, let's say, this corresponds to a vector G max, the kinetic energy of that G max vector remember the Laplacian of e to the I G max is going to be minus G square, and so this kinetic energy is equal to 1/2 G square. So this quantity is called in quantum espresso E cut. It could be the wave function cutoff, or it could be the charge density cutoff. Let me make a little detour. If I have that, say, wave function is written as u times e to the I k dot r, I dropped the index n just for simplicity. And if I look at the square modulus of psi k, that is the charge density, so the charge density rho k for these orbitals is equal to the square modulus of psi k and is equal to the square modulus of uk, because when I take the square modulus, the IIKR modulation goes away. Well, you see, if my uk was written as expansion in plane waves with, you know, certain G vectors of the coefficient C, I call them K, G, e to the I, G dot R, where G has a modulus that is less than the G max cutoff. And now if I'm looking not at UK, but I'm looking at the square modulus of UK, this is UK star times UK. So what I have here is sum over G prime CK G prime star e to the minus I G prime dot R. This is UK star times UK, that is sum over G CK G e to the I G dot R. And lo and behold, you discover, I'll write it here, that the charge density, that is the square modulus of psi, that is the square modulus of u, is written also as a plane wave expansion that is given by CK star G prime CK G e to the I G minus G prime dot R. So what do we discover? You see, we discover that if the cutoff for the wave function was this, that is my G vectors were inside this cutoff sphere, the charge density is described by plane waves that can have a wave vector that span all possible combination of G minus G prime. And of course, G minus G prime, if G and G prime live inside this blue sphere, so G minus G prime are going to live in a sphere that has twice the radius. Because if I take a G here and I take a G prime here, G minus G prime is going to be here. So the cutoff radius for the wave function is going to give me naturally a cutoff radius for the charge density that is twice as large. And because we are not talking about radii, but we are talking with energies associated to that radii, it tells me that the energy cutoff for the wave function is related to the energy cutoff for the charge density by a factor of 4. So if I decided that the energy cutoff for my wave function is 30 Rydberg, the energy cutoff for my charge density needs to be 120 Rydberg. So that was one statement. The second statement that is also important to know, let's do this in black, is that, as I said, Laplacian are easy, and I'll give you an example of how am I going to solve the Poisson equation using a plane wave expansion. So Poisson equation is the Laplacian of V is equal to 4 pi of rho, and suppose that I know that rho is given by a plane wave expansion where the rho g coefficient I know. So I know what is my plane wave expansion. And V, I don't know, I want to solve this equation, and I write V also as a plane wave expansion, but the Vg are not known. Okay, so I wanted to solve this differential equation not in real space, but in reciprocal space, given all the set of rho g's, what is all the set of vg's. And that is, you see, super easy, because I inserted these equations here, and what I get is a sum over g, vg, times minus g square, e to the I g dot r, is equal to 4 pi sum over g, rho g, e to the I g dot r. So plane waves happen to be also orthogonal, and orthonormal, I won't go into the normalization of periodic function here, but so if I take the integral of this expression times the complex conjugate of any plane wave, I will have that, because of orthogonality, that contribution is zero, and instead if my scalar product is with a plane wave that has wave vector g, that is not going to be zero. And so I get right away the solution that is coefficient by coefficient. These plane waves need to have the same coefficient. And so if I have the charge density coefficients, the coefficients of the potential, it could be, you see, the Hartree potential that solves the Poisson equation, are just given plane wave by plane wave by the coefficient of the charge density divided by g square. Now, what happens when you have a very, very large system, a very, very large supercell? Remember that a reciprocal space goes as the inverse of direct space. So as I make my unit cell larger and larger, my G vector, my reciprocal lattice, becomes, you know, made by vectors that are closer and closer. If you remember the expression of the duals, the volume was at the denominator. So if the direct lattice vectors goes up linearly, the reciprocal lattice vector decreases inversely proportional to that. So in a big system, I will have a lot of G vectors that are very small, and if the G can be very small, it means that a little error on the charge density is going to give me a large error, because it's divided by G square, on the equivalent component for the potential. And that's why electrostatics of large system is very tricky. Things that you're studying by first principle, a metal slab with vacuum, or maybe with some molecule looking here and smiling at you. Well, and you're solving this in reciprocal space, so you're taking this charge density, you're Fourier transforming, you're getting the rho g, and then out of that you're getting the vg. A small error on the rho g gives you a big error on the vg, and so it means that all of a sudden you could put a charge density here, and this is a large system, so in the next iteration, there will be an electrostatic imbalance that wants to send back the charge density here. And this divergence in the infinite supercell limit gives rise to what are called the sloshing instabilities that make the convergence, the iterative convergence of first principle calculation slightly delicate. Okay, so as I said, we use plane waves, but we didn't have to do that. A lot of quantum chemistry codes use Gaussian basis set because the exchange integrals are easy to do. There are codes like Crystal that do solids with Gaussian basis set. There are simplified codes that use a linear combination of atomic orbitals. There are codes that use a linear muffin-tin approach that has been introduced by O.K. Anderson in the 70s. I don't know if you know what a muffin-tin is. Muffins have become very popular ever since cupcakes have become very popular. So a muffin-tin is something to bake cupcakes in the oven. And so a muffin-tin approach is an approach where, seen from the above, we partition space in atomic spheres around the atoms, and we use one set of basis sets inside, and in the interstitial valence region, we use plane waves, and we have to match the basis set at the boundaries very well. And that, in particular, LMTO was very powerful when it was first introduced because it could allow to do calculations that before were impossible. These days, we even do better. We use linearized augmented plane wave techniques that, again, use atomic-like basis sets inside the sphere and plane waves in the middle and allow ultimate accuracy. So often, there are a lot of reference calculation or calculation on very delicate properties that can be done rather than using plane waves and pseudopotential, using all electron technique. That would be impossible to deal with plane waves, but with LAPW, you can use atomic orbitals around the nucleus and plane waves in the middle, so you can study the entire system. But again, Quantum Espresso, like VASP, like Abinet, like CASTEP, like many other codes, will use plane waves, and that's what we are going to use. The other technical concept that you need to be familiar to do an ab initio calculation is the one of Brillouin's zone integration. As I said before, there are a lot of quantities that require summing over all the states in the system. Say, let's take silicon, an insulator. My charge density would be given by the sum over all the bands and by integral over all the k in the first Brillouin zone of the square modulus of the u and k. Okay, so we can't do continuous integrals in our calculation, so what we are going to do is we are going to do sampling. That means we take the Brillouin zone and we sample it on a finite discrete mesh of k points, so we don't consider all the blue states, but we consider all the black states. And by increasing the fineness of our k-point sampling mesh, we do better and better. And the general technique is to use equispaced meshes that are called Monkhorst-Pack meshes. I'll show them in a moment. So we are doing something actually quite trivial. We are sampling the Brillouin zone on an equispaced mesh. There are a couple of subtleties, one that I'll describe later. If you have a metallic system, you have a Fermi energy that separates the empty states from the filled states. And if you want to calculate the charge density, say in copper, you have only to sum over the occupied states. And so what you have in a metal is actually a discontinuity. You might be, you know, following a band and integrate things, but as soon as that band crosses the Fermi energy, it doesn't contribute anymore to the charge density of the system. You know, the simplest case could be a case of, you know, a very simple model one-dimensional system that has a Fermi energy here. This is the band structure. So what I have when I do the integral, I need to count these states, but as soon as the states cross the Fermi energy, their occupation goes to zero, so you have to integrate a discontinuous function. Discontinuous functions are much nastier to integrate carefully rather than smooth functions, so insulators are easy to sample in K-space than metals, and we'll get to metals in a moment. The other limit that is interesting is the limit where you study a very large system, and maybe the simplest way to think of this is again taking this band structure here in for a one-dimensional system that was looking like this. You know, this could be, you know, the band structure of a simple monoatomic chain. And as you know, I mean, in real space, I could study this in the primitive unit cell, maybe one atom per unit cell, but no one stops me from studying it in a double unit cell, in a triple unit cell, in a quadruple unit cell. And in reciprocal space, let's say if I double the unit cell, that would correspond to actually having the same system, but described in a different way. Rather than having this Brillouin zone, now I have a Brillouin zone that is one half, and rather than having one band in black, I have, let's say, two bands in orange. So the black band and the two orange bands are describing exactly the same system, but in a different representation. The black one comes with having in direct space one atom per unit cell, the orange comes from having two atoms per unit cell. And as I increase my description in real space, what I get is that my bands get folded and folded and folded. So, you know, I might end up with having something that looks like this. So you see, if I study this system in a very, very big supercell, I have a very small Brillouin zone, and I don't have to do a lot of effort in sampling it because I just sample it at one point, because when I sample it at one point, I get all this point here in the middle that corresponds to taking all this point here. So if your unit cell is very large, you can get away with a very coarse sampling, maybe just one point. It could be the gamma point, it could be the zone boundary. Or you could ask yourself the question, very smart, of, you know, if you can only afford one point, what is the best point that you can choose? And it might not be the origin, it might be something else. And that's called the Balderewski point. And if you're actually dealing with an FCC lattice, that's 1/4, 1/4, 2 pi over A. This was especially relevant when, you know, calculation was so expensive that you could, you know, use, you could spare any CPU that you could, and so you wanted to sample those as little as possible. But it's still very relevant these days. If you are studying your system in a big supercell, then maybe you can get away with only one point, but then maybe the Balderewski point is better than the gamma point because it's actually more accurate. The gamma point has another advantage, that is at gamma point, the wave functions are real, so those coefficients don't require a complex expansion, but you can just get away with half of the informational content. And Quantum Espresso in the gamma-only formulation takes advantage, actually, of this. But in general, this will be what we will do. We will use equispaced meshes. Those are called Monkhorst and Packer from the paper in the mid-70s that described those. Quantum Espresso generates automatically for you, so you don't have to worry very much. But just so that you know what they are, what I have on the right, the 444 unshifted mesh, you see, is just sampling the Brillouin zone with 4 points in every direction. And of course, this point here with a cross is equivalent by symmetry with this point here. And you can have the unshifted mesh, or you could have, with the same fineness of sampling, what is called the shifted mesh, where this k-point sampling are here in the middle of this division. And quantum espresso would take this as a 4-4-4-1-1-1, 4-4-4-0-0-0. One thing that is very important, suppose for a moment we are studying, and this is a real space cell, a carbon nanotube that, you know, we might describe by something like this. In reciprocal space, you'll have also a Brillouin zone, but what happens in your system is that this y direction is the direction of periodicity, and so is the direction in reciprocal space where there will be band dispersion. In reciprocal space, in the x and z direction, there will be no dispersion because the system, the nanotube, is effectively isolated and is not talking with its periodic images. So the states don't have a k dependence in their expectation value for the energy. So the Monkos-Pack mesh that you would use in this case is not maybe a sequence of better and better Monkos-Pack meshes. It could be 2-2-2, 3-3-3, 4-4-4, until your quantities are converged. You don't need to sample in two directions, so they will be 1-2-1, 1-3-1, 1-4-1. And you know, 1-4-1 is going to cost 16 times less than 4-4-4. You have 64 points in one case and only 4 points in the other. So that is also very important to remember. If your system is not truly three-dimensional, but is separated by vacuum, in this case, two-direction, as is the case for a carbon nanotube, or in three-direction, if this was a molecule, for a molecule, you always only use gamma sampling, you know? For a molecule, there is no point in sampling anything because the molecular states don't have any K dispersion. If they have a K dispersion, it means that you don't have a molecule, but the molecule is filling its periodic image, so you're actually having something that is an organic crystal. And if you have, say, a layer of graphene, you sample in the plane, but you don't sample perpendicularly. The last thing that makes actually our calculations less expensive in solids is exploiting a symmetry operation, the point group symmetry of the system. You might have mirror planes, you might have rotation axes. If you are studying a silicon crystal, you actually have 48 symmetry operation of the TD point group. And symmetry is used very effectively in doing these sums, because rather than, say, in this case, if this was my Brillouin zone, rather than summing over all the K that belong to the Brillouin zone, I can use, I will not demonstrate it, but I can use this relation that tells me that if I know the orbital at a certain K, I can obtain the block orbital at a certain, sorry, this is unreadable, at a certain S of K, that is at a K that is related to the previous one by a symmetry operation, simply counter-rotating my points in real space. That is to say that if this point here is K, and this point here is S of K, and they are related by a mirror operation, if I have psi K, the psi S K is obtained by exactly folding back the points according to this operation. So my sum is broken apart. The sum over all the K points becomes a sum over only the K points that live in what is called the irreducible wedge. There's a segment of the Brillouin zone that once we apply all possible symmetry operation, blankets the entire Brillouin zone. Here I had only one mirror symmetry, and so you see the orange wedge plus the mirror symmetry is going to cover also the other half of the Brillouin zone. So here I do the sum over the irreducible wedge, and all other points that are outside the irreducible wedge are not obtained by doing additional calculation, by simply using this asymmetry relation here. So you see, at the end of the day, I have to solve the Cohn-Sham equation only at the irreducible points of the Brillouin zone. And as I said, if I'm studying silicon, is a saving of 48. Of course, you know, a factor of 48 is not, you know, life-changing these days. So sometimes we don't bother with this, but in very complex codes that use a lot of calculation for, say, calculating phonons and electrons and electron-phonon interaction, you know, these savings build up very quickly. One symmetry that is always there if we don't have a magnetic field, so if we don't have a vector potential in a Hamiltonian, is a time reversal symmetry. So what I written here is the Hamiltonian, not anymore for the block function psi, but what happens if I apply H to psi, that is, if I apply H to U n k e to the I k r. So if I put explicitly the block form, it turns out that the Hamiltonian for U n k has this form here, and you see right away that if I solve this Hamiltonian for U n k, the solution for U n minus k is immediately given by taking the complex conjugate of U n k. So always, if this is my Brillouin zone, okay, this is the gamma point, I never need more than half of the Brillouin zone, because the points in the other half, okay, if you know, the points on the left here had, say, negative k, the points on the right have positive k, I get from the one to the other, that is, I go from k to minus k, just taking the complex conjugate. And so you never have to do a full sampling of the Brillouin zone, but worst case scenario, you just have to sample half of it. PWSCF, that is the self-consistent code in Quantum Espresso, is very sophisticated about k-points. It gives you all this option. It gives you the option of just choosing the gamma point for a big supercell, and then your calculation becomes twice as fast and twice as less memory intensive. Most of the time you lose automatic k-point meshes, maybe unshifted with k1, k2, k3, 0, 0, 0, or shifted 1, 1, 1, but you need to test when your calculations are converged with respect to nk1, nk2, and nk3. And the calculation goes linear in the product of these three numbers. So doing a 2-2-2 mesh is 8 times cheaper than doing a 4-4 mesh, that is in itself 8 times cheaper than doing an 8-8-8 mesh, and that is in itself 64 times more expensive than a 2-2-2 mesh. So you want to, you know, proceed carefully, but you need to check that your physical quantities are converged with respect to the k-point sampling. Remember again, you know, if you have a molecule, you just use gamma. If you have a nanotube, you sample only in one direction, or you have a wire, a nanowire. If you have a two-dimensional system or a metal slab with a molecule absorbed, you don't want to sample in the direction perpendicular to this. Okay, so this was a k-point sampling. So we are starting to look at all the computational tools that we need to run a proper calculation. We have looked at the plane wave cutoff, the basis set, the k-point sampling. Let me introduce in very hand-waving form the concept of pseudopotentials. That is the idea that actually when you look at a solid or you look at a molecule, the electrons deep down in the core, say for aluminum, it would be the 1s, the 2s, and the 2p electrons, they are so tightly bound to the nucleus that they don't care if aluminum is in a molecule, is in a bulk solid, is at the surface, or is in molten aluminum. And so for this reason, what we want to do is only study the valence electrons, and the core electrons that are very low in energy, we consider frozen in the atomic configuration. Of course, if you want to study, say, X-ray spectroscopy is where you excite electrons from the core, well, then you need to do something else. We will not go into that, but that are also something that you can calculate with standard density function, of course. So how do we get rid of the need to study core electrons? You see, core electrons have very large negative energies, so a small error on a core electron messes up our calculation because, you know, binding energies are of the order of a fraction of an electron volt. So doing, a 0.1% error in the 1s state completely messes up our calculation. So we don't want to deal with this, and the core electrons are very localized around the nucleus, so they would need a lot of plane waves. So to do that, we introduce the concept of the pseudopotential. What is a pseudopotential? Well, say for the case of aluminum, a pseudopotential is a potential that we create that reproduces the effects not only of the nucleus, minus 13 over R, the Coulombic attraction, but it reproduces the effect of the nucleus screened by the frozen core electrons. And so we want to create that pseudopotential so that when we throw the three valence electron of aluminum in the field of those pseudopotential, the energy of those three electrons will be these energies here, minus 7.8 and minus 2.7, that are exactly the energy that that they would have had if they had felt the full explicit electronic core configuration. So we build pseudopotentials so that a valence electron thrown in that pseudopotential field have the same energies that valence electrons thrown in the true field of the nucleus and all the core states would have. But not only that, we want also that the valence wave function is correct, and we are going to care for the valence wave functions to be correct outside the core. So we want the valence wave function to be correct outside the core, because that's where chemical bonding takes place. And so here you see what I have as a thin line is a Coulombic attractive potential if, say, I have an atom sitting here at the origin. In solid red, in thick red, I have a pseudo-potential that agrees exactly with the true Coulombic potential outside the core and is different inside the core. And this thick red pseudo-potential has been built such that the electron in the field of the pseudo-potential obtains a ground state that is the thick blue curve. And that thick blue curve has two characteristics. One is identical to the thin blue curve that was, this could be the 6s, 7s state in an atom. So outside the core, the pseudo wave function and the true wave function are identical. And also, the energy of the blue state thick is equal to the energy of the thin blue state. How to do that, how to build the pseudopotential, is very complex, but you gain a lot because all of a sudden you don't have to study all those core electrons that are very high energy, so very little error are going to be very harmful, and they are very sharply peaked, so they require an impossibly large cutoff. How do I build these pseudopotentials? There were number of techniques developed, but really at the end of the 70s, Don Hammond, together with Michael Schluter and Chang, developed these ideas of norm-conserving pseudopotentials, and they developed a construction protocol for pseudopotential, where, as I said, the eigenvalues and the agree for the real states and for the pseudo states, the wave functions agree beyond a core radius, the concept of norm conservation told us that the integral of the pseudo wave function and the integral of the pseudo and the real wave function, both squared, that is the real and the pseudo charge, are going to be identical within the core, the integral, and then because the pseudo and the real wave function agree outside the core, they are also going to agree outside the core. And then there is another subtlety that I'll just mention in passing. There is going to be an agreement for, and I'll explain what this is in a moment, what the logarithmic derivatives are and their first energy derivatives. I'll get to that in a moment. But in order to make this non-conserving pseudopotential, it turns out that what you have to do is, you know, you can't really do it with just a local pseudopotential, that is a pseudopotential that depends only on position. You need to act differently on the wave function, that is, you need to act differently on the wave function that looks like an S orbital, or on the wave function that looks like a P orbital, or a wave function that looks like a D orbital. That is to say, in order to act, your pseudopotential takes a scalar product on the spherical harmonics, and you're going to act differently. So this would be the matrix element. You're going to act differently on the component of the wave function that has a non-zero projection onto an S spherical harmonic, onto a P spherical harmonic, onto a D spherical harmonic, and so on and so forth. So a proper non-conserving pseudopotential will act, and it's you know, represented here, differently on the S component of the wave function, on the P component, on the D component, on the F component. And at a certain point, for higher order angular momentum components, it will stop doing that because it's not necessary anymore. So maybe for the case of gallium, we have an S component, a P component, a D component, and we say for anything that has a higher order angular symmetry, will just act in the same way, and that will be the local component of the pseudopotential that might look like this. And again, you see, outside a certain core radius, they all look identical. And if I study, in this case, the gallium atom, you see I'm going to reproduce the S, the P, and the D wave function of the atom exactly outside the core. So this is inside the core, this is outside the core. And inside the core, they are different, they are much smoother. So you see, they are much easier. You see how sharp the S wave function was here. So the 3S, so they are much smoother, but they have still the same energy. And the last concept was this concept of logarithmic derivatives. I won't go into the detail of this, but it comes from scattering theory. The way at the end of this pseudopotential are built comes from the idea that a real core, that is the nucleus plus the real core electrons, and a pseudopotential, that is a potential that represents all of this in a, you know, a unique potential, so there are no core electrons explicit in the pseudopotential. So these two objects, the real core with the nucleus and the pseudopotential, should scatter an incoming plane wave in similar ways. And what does it mean in similar ways? It means that you can take the plane wave, and after the scattering, you can do a Born expansion in spherical waves, and you can represent the effect of the scattering in terms of the phase shifts of all these coefficients. And the non-conserving pseudopotential are built to have, say, the correct phase shift, that's the logarithmic derivative, at one given energy, but they are also transferable. That means that they have the correct derivative, and having not only the absolute value, but also the correct derivative means that those phase shifts are going to be actually good also in the neighborhood. And actually, you see, you can make this phase shift to be good in a very large neighborhood of energy. So that's why the norm conservation concepts of Hamann, Schluter, and Chang was so powerful. Later on in 1985, David Vanderbilt extended this concept and he developed a formalism by which you could impose this condition and not at only one value of energies, but at multiple values. So you could reproduce better and better the scattering from the real core and the pseudo potential in a wider region in energy. And these are the extended non-conserving pseudo potential that are now becoming more and more used because you can make them more accurate than standard non-conserving because they have better scattering properties, but are not so complicated as what had been developed in between, also by David Vanderbilt, the ultra-soft pseudopotentials, or by Peter Bloch, the projected augmented wave method. These two approaches are somehow similar. They tend to make the calculation much less expensive, but they also tend to make the entire algorithm more expensive. I'm looking at my notes. I think today I'm going long, so I'll mention, I think we'll have 20 more minutes to go. If I don't faint, if I faint, that's it. If I don't faint, you know, and you also know that all of this is recorded and will be posted. So if you have to go, you can also watch it later. One thing that is interesting about the ultra-soft pseudopotential, I just do a graph here. Suppose that this was the charge density, the radial charge density of a 3D orbital. Well, the ultra-soft and similarly the projected augmented wave does a very smart, introduces some very smart formalism to make the wave function, the pseudo-wave functions that we have in our calculation, even smoother than what non-conserving pseudo-potential could do. And when they were introduced in the early 90s, it means that materials that were very challenging for plane wave calculation, materials with 2p electrons or 3d electrons. You see, 2p electrons or 3d electrons don't have to be orthogonal to 1p because there is no 1p, or to 2d because there is no 2d. So 2p and 3d electrons are very compressed towards the nucleus, so they need a lot of plane waves. They are very tough to describe. And ultra-soft pseudopotential managed to describe those with very, very smooth pseudo-wave function. But in that, what you lost is that the charge density was not anymore the square of the wave function, but was actually the square of the wave function plus some so-called augmentation terms. Because the charge density is a physical observable, and so if I make my wave function smoother than it should be, I'm not going to have any more that the square of the wave function gives me the true charge density. I need to have this augmentation terms. And so because of this, it means that the relation between the cutoff for the charge density being four times the cutoff for the wave function has become broken. The cutoff for the charge density cannot change because of any computational trick that I do, because that's a physical quantity and that depends on the system I'm studying. With the ultra-soft pseudopotential, I can make the cutoff on the wave function smaller, and so it means that the ratio between these two is not anymore 4, but it could be 6, 7, 8, 10, 12. It's something that in principle you also have to test. Luckily, if you go to the Materials Cloud, we have tested for you a standard set of pseudopotential. We call them a standard solid state pseudopotential, SSSP, and we have prepared them for the case that you want to use a PBE as your exchange correlation potential, or PBE-SOL as your exchange correlation potential. No one has generated, as far as I know, a set of pseudopotential for the scan functional. That would be very good. There are some, but not an entire periodic table. So there are going to be inconsistency when you do scan calculation between your pseudopotential that has been generated using density functional theory for the atom, but with an exchange correlation that is not the one that's using the solid, and I don't like it, and a number of us don't like it. But this is to say that, given the pseudo-potential that you're using, those can be hard. Like if you use non-conserving pseudo-potential for oxygen, they might require a cutoff of 80 Rydberg, 100 Rydberg. If you use ultrasoft pseudo-potential or PAW, you might get away with 30 Rydberg, and there is a huge difference in the cost, but you need to make sure that also your cutoff on the charge density is correct. There is not going to be a factor of four between the two anymore. Let me go to something else as well, the case I wanted to delve a little bit deeper in this concept of metals, that is what happens when you have actually a Fermi energy separating the occupied states by the unoccupied states. And as I said, that makes our integrals that here have been discretized as Monkhorst pack meshes much more tricky, because now we have to say if that state is occupied or not. Okay, so F is equal to 1 occupied or is equal to 0 if the state is unoccupied. So this is really a sharp discontinuity. I was doing my happy integral here, but things drop to zero when this band cuts, and this is very difficult. So during the years, there has been the concept of trying to smooth these discontinuities by introducing a fictitious temperature in the system. You know, suppose that we had a real temperature, now the occupation of my states would be Fermi-Dirac occupations, and while at zero temperatures, the Fermi-Dirac is a step function. It goes from 1 or 2, if you are, say, spin degenerate, to 0. At finite temperature, it's not. It's smoother. And so it means that this discontinuity has now become much smoother. So if you have a temperature in your system, your functional is not anymore the total energy, but is the Helmholtz free energy. That is equal to the total energy minus the temperature times the entropy. Well, this would be the, say, if I have a Fermi-Dirac occupation, would be F log F 1 minus F log of 1 minus F. So this is the proper extension to a finite temperature formalism. And often the temperature, to remind ourselves that it's not a real physical temperature, we call it a smearing sigma. That is, it's just there to smoothen our discontinuity. Quantum Espresso, to confuse you, calls this quantity the total energy also for a metal. But remember, it's not a total energy, it's a total free energy. And so all of a sudden, what happens is that now you have an additional thing to figure out, that is how much temperature or how much smearing you have to give to your system. And things are delicate. Here I'm looking at a physical quantity. I think this is an iron bulk system with a few atoms in the primitive cell. I'm displacing one. I'm measuring calculating the force on an atom. So you see what I'm plotting here is the force on an atom as a function of the smearing. you know, 0.02 Rydberg is equal to 0.27 electron volt, that is roughly equal to, well, let's say 3000 Kelvin. So if we think in physical terms, you know, already 0.02 Rydberg of smearing is an enormous temperature. So what is the right result here? You see, what I'm seeing is that the force that I get changes if I change the smearing and changes if I change the K-point sampling. What I haven't shown you is that if we go to very, very high smearing, we would always get one curve, because at very high smearing, my discontinuity has become so smooth that I can integrate it very well. And you see a remnant of this here at 0.02, you have three or four curves that are almost identical, the ones with, you know, 20, 24, 36 point meshes. But as I decrease the smearing, you know, all this curve starts to become different. Even the best curve that I have, the best curve is the green diamonds here and the black dots here. You see, these two best curves are identical in the high temperature, high smearing region, and then they start to separate. And as you go to very small smearing, things go actually berserk. So it's not that, you know, getting to zero smearing gives you a good result. You are here, you're all over the place. What you would want ideally is the limit of infinite K-point sampling and then zero smearing. But you cannot reach that. So, you know, what you need to figure out roughly, let me remove this very confusing pen marks, is finding, if you want, the plateau around here. And, you know, you need to look at what is, you know, the error that you can tolerate here. And this is an error of, you know, around 0.001, 0.002 electron volt per angstrom. So it's not a big error. But you need to look at the plateau where, you know, with the highest sampling, you roughly have the same results. And as a function of smearing, things are not changing too much. If you go to larger smearings, it's easier to converge, but you converge to the wrong result because you have a lot of temperature. If you go to smaller smearing, you have the right temperature, but your sampling error is killing you. So here, sampling is killing you. And here, temperature is killing you. It's like being in a place where lava falls into ice water. You need to find that comfort zone that is very thin in between these two. But, you know, to make things a little bit more reassuring, I would say that, you know, this interval of smearing tends to be conservatively good. So never go below, never go above, and make sure you have enough K points. And the reason why this is actually a good range is because we have developed 20, 25 years ago what are called generalized entropic formulation that I'll just briefly go through. That is, we have been able to construct formulation that are not leading to a Fermi-Dirac entropy, are leading to a different entropy, and they are such that A, the free energy, as a function of the fictitious temperature sigma, is actually quite flat. That means that if A is flat as a function of temperature, I can do my calculation at high temperature, where my K-point sampling is converged, but this number that I get is actually very, very close to the number I would get at zero temperature. How do we do that? Well, we write the generalized Helmholtz free energy, and we look at the minimum conditions of these functionals. So I minimize it. I have two Lagrange multipliers on the total number of electrons on orthogonality. And I have the derivatives, functional derivatives with respect to the wave function, and I have the derivative with respect to the occupations. And in particular, these derivatives gives me a constructive relation between the expectation value of the Hamiltonian, that's not the eigenvalue, it's the expectation value of the Hamiltonian on the psi I, minus the Fermi energy, the chemical potential mu, and this is equal to T times the derivative of the entropy with respect to the occupation. So this can be written also epsilon I minus mu divided by T needs to be equal to the derivative of the entropy with respect to the occupation. So from this, we can do something very simple. That is, you know, these ideas of smearing, this idea of an occupation being a smooth function of the temperature, where this variable is epsilon versus T, was introduced already in the mid-80s by Fu and Do, that said, well, you know, let's take a broadening of a Dirac delta, it could be a Gaussian, and we calculate the occupation as this integral. You see, if epsilon is very large, this integral is going to give me one. Sorry, this is, yeah. So if epsilon is very large, this integral is going to give me zero. And if epsilon is very negative, this integral is going to give me one. If epsilon is equal to mu, this integral is going to give me one half. And, you know, they proposed different forms. Let me not get into this now. So remember what we had before. So we had this constitutive relation between the expectation value of the Hamiltonian and the entropy. We have defined the occupation as an integral of a broadening function G that we decide. This is a broadening function, and there is a very beautiful relation that Alessandro De Vita and Mike Gillan developed in the early 90s that then tells me, well, if that is the case, so if F is written as an integral of a broadened occupation, the entropy is the integral of minus whatever variables T times the broadened occupation GT. So there is, if you want, a very simple way to go from broadening G to entropy S. So you can choose your broadening, you can take your Dirac delta, and you can broaden it in very many different ways. And this construction will tell you what is the form of the entropy that needs to go into your Helmholtz free energy here. And so we use this concept to build a broadening function, delta tilde, that had a number of quality that is, of course, is normalized, that for which this integral was giving zero. That means that the entropy at zero temperature is zero. But in particular, we built distribution functions, broadened delta, that had a second moment that is equal to zero. And having this second moment equal to zero was demonstrated by Stefano De Gironcoli that is equivalent to having the free energy not be, say, linear or quadratic as a function of temperature, but actually to have only cubic or quartic terms as a function of temperature. And this is an example of the broadening function. This is called cold smearing in quantum espresso. There are other variation on the theme. There is the Metfessel and Paxton, which was actually introduced first and doesn't go through this if you want, conceptual derivation of a free energy functional. The Matveyev-Paxson has the slight defects that can give rise to negative occupancies, that is something that we do not like, but both of these broadening distribution have a zero second moment. That means that the free energy does not depend on temperature up to the cubic order. And I have a plot here for the case of aluminum, in which I plot here E minus TS, and I plot here E, and you see how the free energy is quadratic in temperature. The total energy is actually quadratic with the opposite coefficient. It was realized very early on that if we were to take the semi-sum, this is what Mike Gillan called the corrected energy, E minus 1/2 TS, we would have, you see, with very large smearing, now these are electron volts, a very good estimate of the zero value term. Remember that this is the no-go zone where we can't do good sampling in there. But this is just good for the total energy. The functional is still the free energy, so the stress and the forces that would come out would not be corrected. But the generalized smearing formulation, like the cold smearing, the Matveyev-Paxson, do both. They both give you a free energy that, in the case of the cold smearing, say, you see, it goes like this. You see how much flatter it is than the free energy. The free energy, you see, it's exploding. And remember, this is the region where we are doing our calculations. But because it's a variational functional, we can calculate also forces and stresses and all derived quantities. So let me summarize what are, you know, all the ingredients that you'll find in your homework to do a self-consistent calculation. You need to figure out what is the translational symmetry of your system, what is your Bravais lattice, what is the group of atoms that we call the basis for the crystal structure, that is the atoms that are periodically repeated by the Bravais translation, and they will give rise to the entire real crystal. So for silicon, you would have a basis of two atoms. For gallium arsenide, also a basis of two atoms and an FCC Bravais lattice. For aluminum, you would have one atom and the FCC Bravais lattice. For BCC iron, you would have one atom and the BCC Bravais lattice. But of course, if you want to study a defect in silicon, then you might need to construct a much bigger primitive unit cell with maybe 64 atoms, where then you remove one of these atoms. So you need to construct your crystals. You need to get your pseudopotentials from somewhere, from the SSSP, from the Quantum Espresso website, from the PseudoDojo website. You need to find out what is the correct cutoff energy for your wave function. The SSSP website gives you suggestions. What is the correct cutoff for the charge density? 4 times larger for non-conserving pseudopotential, but maybe more and more for ultra-soft pseudopotentials. What is the appropriate Monkhorst pack mesh? What is the fictitious temperature that you can use? And then you need to make sure that you have a good technique to get to self-consistency. And I'll discuss that in a moment. If you are desperate, you can go to the Materials Cloud. In the Work Tool, there is something called the Quantum Espresso Input Generator that allows you to very simply upload a structure, choose a table of pseudopotential for PBE or PBSol, either efficiency, that is less accurate but less expensive, or accuracy, more accurate. And then you just have to decide if your system is insulating or metallic, and if it's magnetic or non-magnetic, and you decide one of the standard three meshes of K-points, and Quantum Espresso generates, the Quantum Espresso input generator generates for you the input file. And if you want to plot band structure, there is another tool called SigPath that gives you also the appropriate crystallographic approved path in the brilliant zone. So let me conclude for today. I think I'm going a little bit longer. Let's try to do this in 8 minutes with you know, how to get to self-consistence. And exactly as in Hart, in Archie Falk, in Kone Sham, we need to get to the self-consistent solution of these equations. So, you know, once we set up our problem with all these computational parameters, we need to construct, you know, the Hartree operator, the exchange correlation operator. So we need to, you know, have actually a starting electronic density to then iterate. And so this is typically given by sums of atomic densities. At this point, so we can construct the Hartree operator, the exchange correlation operator. So we have the Hamiltonian. For that Hamiltonian, we solve the Kone-Sham equation. This Kone-Sham equation gives us a set of, you know, phi 1, phi n for a molecule, or a phi 1k, phi nk for a solid with k belonging to the Monkhorst pack mesh. Now with these phis, we calculate the new charge density. This was maybe rho 0. Now we have rho 1, and with rho 1, we construct the Hartree and exchange correlation operator. We solve, we get a rho 2, we iterate until things stop changing. And, you know, this process can get to self-consistency. More often than not, this process would actually not converge, but you can get a little bit smarter and introduce a damping term. You can say that the new charge density that enters into this loop is not equal to the old, but is actually just equal to a fraction of the old plus the remaining of the previous one. So you sort of mix the charge density in an iterative way. By making beta very small, you slow down the process of updating what was your initial starting condition, so you much more smoothly move around, and if you're lucky, it becomes easier to converge, although you might also be slower. And this is actually what is taken from the review of modern physics of Mike Payne on the total energy pseudopotential plane wave method from 1992. This is exactly what I said, just in graphical form. So, but you know, if you don't converge and you decrease your beta and nothing happens, you just might be unlucky and your system, you know, is very tough to converge. Maybe it's very large, maybe it has sloshing instability, maybe it has two levels, one empty and one full, that, you know, keep oscillating back and forth, and you know which one to fill. And so I wanted to introduce the complementary approach that maybe might be less efficient, but is much more robust to converge total energy plane wave calculation, that is based on variational recipes. That is the idea that I've given before, that rather than iterating to self-consistency the Hamiltonian and the Kone-Sham equation, you could do a direct nonlinear minimization of the energy function. And to give you an example, I've written here the kinetic energy for a simple case. I haven't put k points. I've just put, say, orbitals with just a discrete index n expanded in plane waves. And, you know, in the energy, as I already told you, there is, you know, for the every plane wave, we have a 1/2 g square component. And so the expression of the kinetic energy for a given orbital and then summed over all the orbital is, you see, sum over all the orbitals, 1/2, sum over all the plane waves, the square modulus of the coefficient of the plane waves. So the kinetic energy is quadratic in the coefficient of the plane waves, but there is not only the kinetic energy, there is also the potential energies in the system, and now the potential energy is not diagonal like the kinetic energy in the basis of plane waves. So the matrix element between G and G prime is not zero, as in the kinetic energy. So the Hamiltonian is as kinetic energy on the diagonal and potential energy everywhere. This is the Hamiltonian in a basis of plane waves. And the matrix element of the potential are nothing else. So you see, this is just the coefficient of the Fourier transform of the potential in real space with respect to a plane wave, exponential of I g prime minus g. So if we put the two together, and if for a moment the Hamiltonian, the total energy of the system, was just given by a kinetic energy term and a potential term, without considering that in Kone-Shama we have the external potential, the Hartree potential, the exchange correlation potential, but you see there is a little star here that's difficult to see, this would be the expression of the energy, and we can minimize it with respect to all these coefficients. So finding the ground state can be seen not as an iterative process, but as a minimization of this form that is here. It looks like a quadratic form on the coefficient Cg, but once we have not only the, say, external potential, but we have the external, the Hartree, and the exchange correlation, in this potential, the charge density enters, so this coefficient enters inside the Fourier transform of the potential, making this a nonlinear minimization problem. But, you know, it's still a problem that, you know, people have studied, and so we can try to minimize this in the space of all the possible coefficients. So I've written it here again, my approximate here energy functional, because I don't have Hartree and exchange correlation. So I can minimize it in the space of all these coefficients. So it's a multidimensional minimization. Remember that you might have thousands or tens of thousands or hundreds of thousands of coefficients. How do I minimize in a space of coefficients? Well, maybe I'm somewhere here in the space of coefficient, that is, I have certain values, and I need to evolve to get to the minimum of the energy in this multidimensional space of, you know, 10,000 dimensions, and each coefficient has its own dimension, and I need to get to the global minimum. But the process is similar to what you would see in a, say, this case, one-dimensional or two-dimensional system. Maybe we have a two-dimensional space of coefficients and we want to get to the minimum of this energy in the space of C1 and C2. There are a lot of techniques, but one thing that you want to know is what is the derivative of the energy with respect to C1 or C2, because that gives you the right direction, the right gradient where to move. So in general, this is written in a compact form. We need to know what is the derivative of the energy, in this case, a functional derivative, with respect to maybe these are just real coefficients. And actually, it turns out that this derivatives is just given by the application of the Hamiltonian to psi I. So if I have a wave function, the application of the Hamiltonian gives me the direction where to move minus. And so I can start to find the ways with these derivatives to go to the bottom. And there are a sort of two main ways to go to the bottom. One is to say, well, if I'm here and I feel a force like this, I can use that force as an acceleration. So, you know, I'll start moving in the space of coefficients towards the bottom, but because I'm feeling the force as an acceleration, by the time I'm here, I have a zero acceleration, but I have still a velocity. And so, you know, without any damping, I would oscillate forever. And so I need to put some damping here to make sure that at the end I converge to this ground state. The other possibility would be to say that I instead move with a velocity. This is, you see, acceleration versus velocity, one dot or two dots. So if I have a force that is proportional to the velocity, again, I'll start moving, but a force that is proportional to the velocity means that I have critical slowing down. As I get closer and closer to the minimum, I never reach it because my driving force goes to zero. So the first recipe that we'll call Carparinello and the second recipe that we'll call conjugate gradients have the defect, one, that Carparinello overshoots the minimum and it has to be dumped down. Conjugate gradient has a critical slowing down and it has to be pushed to get to the minimum. But these are the two main techniques. Conjugate gradient comes again from some mathematical analysis in which if you have, say, a potential energy surface that is very asymmetric and you use the gradients to get to the bottom. So you see here, I'm moving along the gradient until the derivative along that direction is zero, then I move along the gradient, then I move along the gradient. I zigzag to the bottom, and it's much better once I've taken the first step not to move in the steepest descent direction, but to move in a, what is called a conjugate direction that takes the steepest direction, but tries to make sure that as you move in the direction, you don't lose the minimization that you have done before. You see, if I were here, I'm moving along the steepest direction. It's true that I would improve along that, but I would do worse with respect to what I'd done at the previous iteration. So conjugate gradients does that, and conjugate gradients techniques have what have been used in a lot of codes, CASTEP especially, to get in a very robust way to the ground state. And I'll skip that when you are to the ground state. We'll see that tomorrow you can calculate forces and then maybe let atoms move using molecular dynamics techniques. But exactly, if I'm looking at a system during a time evolution, so if the atoms move, every time an atom moves, I have a new potential energy surface, and so I have to minimize, and so getting to the minimum at every step is an expensive operation. And that's the idea that came to Karen Parinello in the mid-1980s, that is to say, well, let's try to find a way by which we don't have to reach the minimum of this, you know, total energy is the function of the coefficient space at every step, but we teach the coefficient how to evolve themselves so that they follow, maybe not exactly, but they follow very closely what would be their minimum at every instant, in at every time step. So this could be time zero, this could be time zero plus delta t, this could be time zero plus two delta t, and so on and so forth. And Karen Parinello did that through the idea of extended Lagrangian, that is, rather than having a standard Lagrangian with the kinetic energy minus the potential energy of our system, that is the electronic energy, the Kone-Sham energy, what they did is that they introduced a dynamics also for the coefficients of the orbitals. You see here there are the velocity of the orbitals. So this is like a physical kinetic energy for the atoms, and this is a fictitious kinetic energies for the plane wave coefficients. But by making the mass of these fictitious plane wave coefficients that are now thrown in into my dynamical algorithm, by making this mass very, very small, it's like making them the flies in the cow. The cow that are the atoms can move, and these coefficients don't affect the dynamics, but just follows the atoms and very quickly rearrange themselves in that blue line at the bottom of the evolving potential energy surface. So this would be the extended Carparinello-Lagrangian. It gives rise to equation of motion, not only for the atoms, but also for the coefficients that learn how to follow. And once you look at the actually constant of motions, you discover that because you are integrating the extended Lagrangian, you have a constant of motion where the kinetic energy of the atoms is, the potential energy of the atom is, but there is also this kinetic energies of the coefficient of the plane waves. And that's, you know, it's just a computational trick, but by making this effective mass very small, it can be negligible. And also the blue curve that would be this expression becomes closer and closer to the red curve that would be the right expression. The only cost that you have to pay if you make mu too small is that the coefficient of the plane waves change so fast that your time step for the Carparinello integration needs to become very small. And that's a bit of a technicality. But if you're able to do this calculation well, things can become very efficient. You have a very flat physical constant of motion because the total constant of motion is very well preserved, and this unphysical quantity is very small and very flat. These kinetic energies, you know, we have hundreds of thousands of coefficients of plane waves, but their total kinetic energy can be a tiny fraction, 1/10, 1/20th of the true physical kinetic energy of the ions. So the coefficient of the plane waves follow, but they don't give back energies to the ions. So in a nutshell, you can do a Born-Oppenheimer molecular dynamic simulation where you move the ions, you converge the electrons back to the ground state with, say, iterative procedure or conjugate gradient procedures. But you're always a sort of, you know, you have always a little bit of a systematic error, so your constant of motion will not be very constant. Instead, with Carparinello techniques, your constant of motion is exact, but you need to make sure that you have integrated them accurately. Things can go well in a semiconductor insulator. The issue, and then I'll conclude, is what happens if you have a metal. And if you have a metal in a variational algorithm is that you start to have 3 degrees of freedom. That is, you need to evolve your wave function, but you need also to evolve your occupations. And you need to make sure that your occupations are calculated on the eigenvalues of the Hamiltonian. So you know what is the representation that diagonalizes the Hamiltonian so that you can get the actual eigenvalues of the system. So in a metal, as opposed to a semiconductor or an insulator, you don't have to evolve only the wave functions. In a semiconductor or insulator, the total energy is invariant for unitary transformation, so you don't care about that. But instead, in a metal, you need to make sure that you evolve also the occupations that can change from 0 to 1, or they can be fractionary. And you always need to know what is the eigenvalue of the Hamiltonian. That is, you need to be in the representation where you can calculate eigenvalues because the problem is not invariant anymore. So you have, if you want, 2 additional degrees of freedom, occupation numbers and unitary rotations. And these occupation numbers can be very effectively combined with the unitary rotation to say, in a metal, the additional degree of freedom is actually a matrix that is the representation. Say if this was a standard finite temperature problem, it would be the representation of the Fermi-Dirac operator on the basis of wave function psi I, and in general, this matrix is non-diagonal. And so to deal with this non-diagonal matrix, you need to write the charge density in a covariant form like this, and you need to write the total energy and the external potential in a covariant form as a double form. And of course, you could always choose a special representation in which this F is diagonal, but then you would need also to evolve the unitary matrices that connect the psi H psi with its eigenvalues epsilon I. So there is no winning. I mean, you have all this complexity. And the nice thing about this covariant representation is that it allows you to define this functional G that is defined as the minimum of the free energy functional with respect to this matrix representation of the occupations. And you see, this functional G is a functional where occupations have disappeared. Not only that, but is a functional that is invariant for a unitary transformation of the orbital. So if I take the psi and I send them into psi u, where u is a unitary matrix, I've done a unitary transformation, what happens is that the values of this functional doesn't change, because if I do a transformation of the psi into psi u, what I can do is a transformation of the u into u dagger f u, and the value has not changed. So if I rotate the psi, the f counter rotates and the minimum doesn't change. So this trick gives me a functional G that looks like the functional of a semiconductor or an insulator. It doesn't have explicit occupation numbers, and it's invariant for unitary transformation, so I can do conjugate gradient, iterative techniques, and so on in this, and I can get to very stable molecular dynamics again. This is called, we called it ensemble DFT. It's coded in VASP. This was actually done by Freisold and collaborators. It's coded in CASTEP. It's not coded in Quantum Espresso. That's somehow very sad. But I think in a few months, we'll be able to make a release of this together with the GPU library series that Anton Kozesnikov and collaborator are developing at CS. So I think this endeth the second lesson. I've been only 45 minutes longer. I think there were a lot of technicalities, so I figured out that only people that want to do actual calculations were going to follow this and be interested in this. Tomorrow we'll go back to 2 hours and a much more conceptual discussion. This will be recorded, will be put on the Materials Cloud. If you want to do the calculation, go to the Materials Cloud. In the Fireside section, there is a link to GitHub. There is a complete handout that tells you how to download and install Quantum Espresso, or how to download and install the Quantum Mobile, the virtual machine with Quantum Espresso preloaded into it. And one by one, there are homeworks that tells you and, you know, teach you how to set up the cutoff for your calculation, how to check the K-point sampling, how to do a simple calculation, an equation of state for sodium chloride. If you are lost, the Quantum Espresso input generator always gives you a good start to, you know, have a good choice for an input file for Quantum Espresso. The SSSP library gives you tested pseudopotential and tested cutoff, and there is always a mailing list where you can ask questions for the Quantum Espresso users. And if you're interested also in more on this, we have put on the Learn section also, you can enroll in a mailing list for more Fireside chats. With this, I'll conclude. The panelists have collected all your questions. We'll put them in a PDF. In the next few days, we'll refine them and we'll post them next week. Other than this, I look forward to seeing you tomorrow, and this will also be posted on the Learn section. Thanks a lot, and thanks especially exactly to Davide, Francesco, Luca, and Norma that have prepared the handout and have been sitting here all these 2 hours and 45 minutes listening to this. And, you know, see you indirectly tomorrow.